Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Just think about what we can accomplish in the first 100 days.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and it is possible that on exactly day 100, which will be this coming Saturday, the government will shut down over Donald Trump's signature issue, the wall. Congress has to pass a funding bill by then, and billions of U.S. tax dollars for the wall that Trump campaigned saying Mexico will pay for, those tax dollars are a big stumbling block. Trump's first government shutdown deadline comes as a Washington Post ABC News poll finds him with the lowest approval rating at this point in his term of any president since the poll began in the Eisenhower administration. He's at 42%, and only 38% say he's honest and trustworthy. But people who voted for Trump have no regrets. Just 2% of Trump voters answered yes to a buyer's remorse question. And the poll found if the election were rerun today, Trump would beat Clinton in the popular vote by about 3 points. And that looks to be a pretty good number because about the same percentage of people who voted for Clinton and voted for Trump were represented in the poll. And on the question of whether the Democratic Party is in touch with the concerns of most Americans, that number dropped from 48% saying yes in 2014 to just 28% saying the Democratic Party is in touch with the concerns of most Americans in this new Washington Post ABC News poll. My first guest today is Washington Post White House and congressional correspondent Robert Costa, who has also just been named the new moderator of Washington Week on PBS, succeeding the late, great Gwen Ifill in that role on the Friday night 8 p.m. program that just celebrated its 50th anniversary. Bob debuted in the permanent seat on Friday night. Bob, welcome back to WNYC. And first of all, congratulations on Washington Week. It's a great honor to get that position for anyone. And I know you knew Gwen, so I wonder if you want to start maybe by talking about that line of succession and how you see that job today.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks for the kind words and the encouragement and for having me on. It's an honor and so humbling to follow Gwen Ifill, who was a friend and was such a wonderful person. Everyone who knew Gwen Ifill, whether you were my age, I'm 31, or whether you've known her for decades, just came away with such respect for her integrity as a reporter and for the humanity she always brought to interactions, whether it was on air or off air. When someone has such a legacy and reputation like Gwen, it's impossible to, as I say, follow Gwen Ifill or fill those shoes. But I think what all I'm trying to do as a reporter is just be inspired by her, continue the show in her spirit, not change a thing, keep it focused on reporting and bring the best reporters I can around a round table, simple setup on a Friday night, and just try to keep it as in-depth and as civil as possible. And I think if I can do that, I won't ever be able to follow her in a big way, but I can at least honor what she did.
And you got this partly because of your credibility across the political spectrum. You were Washington editor at the Conservative National Review and a frequent guest on the Conservative Kudlow Report on CNBC. But you've been at the Washington Post for 3 years now, and I see that even as you take the reins at Washington Week, you'll continue as an NBC and MSNBC political analyst, and all of this at age 31 for people who don't know your baby face from television yet. How'd you wind up coming up through National Review, and how has that informed your reporting for the non-ideologically identified Washington Post?
You're right. It's not the usual path to this kind of job. I acknowledge that. It's a reality and a fact. My path was a more winding one. Long story short, I was a graduate student at University of Cambridge studying Winston Churchill in 2009, and I was over there, and I didn't have any money, so I couldn't come over to the U.S. to interview for jobs, and I was looking for a journalism job. Couldn't find anything. And then I got an opportunity to start as a reporter at National Review covering movement politics and the Republican Party. I thought to myself at 22 years old, this could be a heck of an opportunity to cover national politics. My politics at the time were unformed. So I told National Review I'm not a political guy or a partisan guy, but if you want someone to report on the Republican Party, almost like it's a trade journal, like a Car and Driver magazine, and you want to cover cars, I cover the Republican Party in the same way. Doesn't mean you love the car industry if you work for Car and Driver, but you cover them objectively. They said, sure, we'll have you do that. And so I did that for 4.5 years, became the Washington bureau chief. And even though I was always at National Review when I was there, I really took care to be a reporter and just a reporter and build up my sources in national politics, not because of my views, which I try to be a sphinx if I can and keep them to myself, and just be a reporter. And I think the Washington Post thankfully recognized that, and had a wonderful experience with the Post and now with NBC as well and PBS. Because I think of what's important in my job and all these jobs I have is to just bring a mirror, reflect what's happening, stay cool, and just let people decide and try to give them as much information and sharp analysis to help them form their own opinions without me trying to hammer anything into them.
Robert Costa with us, Washington Post, White House and congressional reporter, and now the new host of Washington Week on PBS. And for anyone who thinks your first official night as permanent host of Washington Week on Friday night slowed you down, I see you have not just the one, but the two top articles on my Washington Post app this morning, one about Trump's cable TV obsession and one about the wall as the focus of the government showdown and possible shutdown this week. Let me play a clip of Trump's budget director, Mick Mulvaney, on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace.
Will he sign a government funding bill that does not include funding for the border wall?
Yeah, and I think you saw his answer just in your little lead-in, which is we don't know yet. We are asking for our priorities. And importantly, we are offering to give Democrats some of their priorities as well. They've made it very clear they want these cost-sharing reduction payments as part of Obamacare. We don't like those very much, but we have offered to open the discussions to give the Democrats something they want in order to get something we want.
Mick Mulvaney, the budget director on Fox News Sunday. So, Bob, I can't imagine the Democrats making a deal of the wall for Obamacare funding. The wall is so emblematic of what Democrats around the country see as Trump's bigotry. If their elected representatives vote to fund the wall right now just to keep Obamacare reasonably funded, I think there would be primaries from New York to L.A., Miami to Seattle. What do you think?
100%. I mean, the Democrats are not going to move toward any kind of wall funding. But there's a lot of nuance right here we got to pay attention to this week, because there's going to be a lot of talk from the White House that they're going to push for wall funding. But here's the real story. And I spoke to White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus yesterday for that front page story today. And what the White House may have to accept is that they may not get funding explicitly for the wall this week as part of a government spending package. But what they could get is money for the border, for broader border security efforts that some Democrats could support if that money is not being directed toward the wall. This is how Washington really works. It's the president's going to be out there saying, I got wall funding and we're moving toward the wall. But is it really going to be for the wall or not? That's something to watch this week. I think that latter option may be what's going to happen, because if the government is going to stay funded, it's probably not going to be able to have wall funding included in the package.
And you reported that the president on Sunday yesterday was pressing congressional Republicans on the wall and the spending showdown. What's the Republican-on-Republican dynamic?
There's immense pressure from the top, from the president to his aides, to others on Capitol Hill, that the 100-day mark matters, even though he keeps shrugging about it publicly. Inside the White House, it matters to the president. And he wants, when he goes to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania this coming Saturday for a big rally, he wants to rail against the political class while he's there, because most of them will be at the White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington that evening. But he also wants to talk about accomplishments. And he wants to have something in terms of legislation to talk about, because for now it's really been about Judge Gorsuch on the Supreme Court and the failure in health care. That's why they're trying to revive health care this week at the White House and also move forward on taxes and on border funding for the wall. But this is a Congress dominated by Republicans in both chambers. But these are not Trump Republicans, and that's one of the central tensions in Washington. This Republican Congress is not always eager to go along with the president's ambitions.
But they would need some Democratic votes for wall funding, because I believe, if I'm not mistaken, that this comes under the 60-vote standard of, you know, everything can be filibustered in the Senate. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's why it's going to be very hard to see how wall funding gets through the Senate. The only things that can pass in the U.S. Senate without needing 60 votes, without that filibuster threshold, are things that have to do with taxes. And that's why you see this move on health care is really a tax bill to get rid of some of the Obamacare taxes. But border funding demands 60 votes. And Democrats have said to Republicans in recent weeks, some of the top appropriators in Congress, we'll work with you on border funding, because for a lot of Democrats, border security is actually a winner in their private polling and in many of their states. It's just the wall itself, that physical structure that they don't want to be involved with.
So we could have one of these government shutdowns, or really partial government shutdowns, because really certain things like the military and other stuff that are considered indispensable continue to go anyway. But what do you see as the most realistic ways that this could end up by the time we get to Friday night?
So here's how I think it ends up. I've been covering these congressional Republicans for a long time. I think it gets Thursday, Friday, they always wait to the 11th hour, and then they're going to probably have to pass a short-term CR. In layman's language, that's really a Band-Aid. They need to put on another Band-Aid to keep the government running and from shutting down. And so they'll keep, I think, extending the government funding as is for a short term until they cut some kind of deal that gives Trump something he can talk about as a political win on border funding. Maybe not wall funding, but border funding. But I think Ryan and McConnell in the Congress, the two leaders, don't want to have a shutdown for obvious reasons politically ahead of 2018. So they'll have tense talks this week. It'll be high drama. And the White House hasn't made it easy for these Republicans, because just keeping the government running alone and talking through border security would be more than enough drama for this crowd on Capitol Hill. But the president's added unveiling a tax plan and trying to bring back health care. That's a lot.
And they'll be unveiling some kind of tax plan blueprint on Wednesday, the president keeps saying. So once that comes out, we'll be talking about it more later in the week here on the show. But I imagine the politics of this from a Trump perspective are maybe on the one hand, because he's trying to stir things up and his base follows him when he does make trouble, they wouldn't mind having a little government shutdown and they could blame the Democrats in Congress. And, you know, maybe that's a kind of Steve Bannon, throw the grenades into wherever you throw grenades and see what happens kind of political strategy. But on the other hand, it would happen exactly on day 100. And so Trump would look like he failed to get health care through. He's got no other legislation through. His travel ban was blocked in the courts. And on day 100, the government shuts down. You know, there's a lot of other things that they've done, but that would certainly look like an immense failure for the first 100 days if that were to happen on Saturday per se. So how do you see the politics internally at the White House?
Your point's a provocative one, but it seeped in true. When I was reporting on the White House late last night, I did get this sense that the president – wants to move in this rat-a-tat fashion this week to try to get Congress jittery, to try to animate them in a way toward him to get things moving. He wants fast action, healthcare, taxes, border, government funding. He's frustrated with how Congress failed on healthcare. He wasn't able to close the deal on healthcare. And so as he approaches day 100, he's okay if it becomes heightened tension. And just as long as things start moving, and he, because his presidency has become one about executive order and executive power and appointments more than anything. And he wants to have some kind of legislative accomplishment. So you could see him really trying to get Congress and Ryan and McConnell to move with him on all these different fronts.
My guest is Robert Costa, Washington Post, White House and congressional correspondent, NBC News analyst, and now the new host of Washington Week on PBS, Friday nights at 8. By the way, do you do Washington Week live on Friday nights, or do you pre-record a few hours before?
No, it's always live, 8 o'clock on Friday nights from Northern Virginia at the studio that Washington Week has been broadcasting from since 1967.
It is live. I was going to say, if you pre-tape, then this week, with all of what we were just describing and that midnight deadline, you might have had to do a special live breaking news edition, but you'll be live anyway. listeners, we have time for a couple of phone calls for Robert Costa. If anyone wants to get in, 212-433-WNYC, 433. 9692. And let me get your take on some of the Washington Post ABC News poll results. Trump has record low approval ratings for a first 100 days at 42%, but merely a 2% buyer's remorse response among people who voted for him. So none of these things that have looked so heinous or incompetent to Democrats since Trump took office, from the travel bans to the health reform failure to the Russia investigations and revelations, all of that has peeled support from approximately zero Trump voters. Does that all indicate we are exactly as polarized a country as we were on Election Day?
Perhaps. It also shows that this Trump base that's out there of almost politically isolated people, whether they're former Democrats or hardcore Republicans, often working class areas that have seen industrialization fall away from their communities. This group still sees – and I was just in Atlanta for the special election, drove around Georgia in the past week, a Republican area. These voters still see Trump in many ways as a change agent, a disruptor of a political class in a global economy. Two groups and institutions that they feel have betrayed them, and they feel this in a very visceral way. Don't like to generalize for all voters, but I really see this across my reporting when I encounter Trump supporters. They're still with him, and it's not really a personality cult per se with President Trump, but they see him as someone who can counter with what they really feel is a failure in Washington and in the economy. So I'm not surprised by that element of the polling, but it's when you look at some of these more moderate, independent, moderate Republican voters, that's where the play is in the poll and in these special elections in Kansas and Georgia. We're seeing the more moderate temperament voters, more moderate politics voters starting to be skittish about President Trump, his lack of accomplishment, the way he's behaved in office. As much as they themselves are as frustrated as Trump's base with the economy and with the political class, they don't like in some respects the way he's presiding over his office. And that's, I think, something Democrats are going to try to take advantage of in 2018, these uneasy centrists.
So this poll, following the events of the first, 95 days, I think we're at 95 days right now today, kind of proves Trump's line from the campaign that he could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue in broad daylight and his supporters would still be with him.
I'm not sure if that can still happen now, but the point is a fair one, if extreme, by President Trump. His supporters are there, but that support is not reflected in the Congress. And so as he goes to Harrisburg this coming week to celebrate 100 days with his base in central Pennsylvania, and he still goes around the country like he was in Wisconsin last week, and he sees these hardcore voters for him. The Congress is still Republican-run, but it's movement conservatives, Paul Ryan types, who are making policy. And they themselves have some private qualms and issues with President Trump and the way he's going about his business. And so that as much as he has this base, it's not really helping him in Washington yet.
And this 2%, only 2% of Trump voters say they have buyer's remorse. I'm not sure how that squares with how unpopular he is. If there are moderates who are peeling off from seeing Trump positively when they did previously or enough to vote for him at any rate, what do none of the would there not be a group of quote-unquote moderates who decided to take a chance on Trump on Election Day and now regret it?
So many voters I've encountered voted against Secretary Clinton because they saw her as an extension of either an administration or a kind of politics they wanted to not see running the country anymore. And it was against her more than for Trump. So Trump still has to find a way to win over people he actually won. So he didn't win the popular vote. And even his vote in many ways was anti-Clinton rather than pro-Trump. And the complicated issue for the president is he doesn't have a coherent ideology. He's a pugilist who runs on instinct rather than some kind of doctrine, whether it's foreign policy. He's had a messy worldview. At times he seems non-interventionist when he criticizes the Iraq intervention. Now when he launches 59 Tomahawks in Syria, he seems like a traditional Republican hawk. And it's a complicated president who – Republicans are heartened by the idea that if he becomes more unpopular, he can move to the center because he doesn't have this ideological center that he's always going to abide by. But he can seem listless at times politically whether it's on foreign or domestic policy. And it's, as much as he's moderate and has some appeal to populists on the Democratic side, he's not making overtures to them in a coherent way day in, day out.
Jack in North Brunswick, you're on WNYC with Robert Costa. Hi, Jack.
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
Okay.
My question regards Jason Chaffetz. He announced that he's not going to run for his seat again. Is it because he's afraid of an ethics violation, or is he planning to run for higher office?
And for people who don't follow national politics enough to know who Jason Chaffetz is, he's a very, very conservative Republican congressman from Utah who is chair of the House Oversight Committee. So he was a big, big hawk on Benghazi, for example. And he started recently, Robert, am I right, to make some more hawkish noises on the Trump-Russia investigation. And then he shocked the Washington political world by saying he wasn't going to run for re-election next year. So what's the Jason Chaffetz story, and does it have larger implications?
It does have larger implications. I mean, the question of oversight of this administration remains a looming one. Who's actually going to keep an eye on the family business, on Jared Kushner, on Ivanka Trump, now both White House employees? Who in Congress, in this Republican Congress, is really going to apply the necessary scrutiny to this administration when it comes to all the financial entanglements? Chaffetz had not been aggressive in going after the administration. It's going to be interesting to watch who succeeds him. But the mystery of Chaffetz's decision remains a mystery. There's talk that he maybe wants to run for governor of Utah in 2020. Chaffetz has insisted in interviews and in a statement that there's no scandal or some kind of political intrigue that's driving him out of office. But he's not just likely to leave, not run for re-election. He's likely to step down from Congress. So maybe he has a job in line or something like that. But Chaffetz, I think, is a fascinating person because if Secretary Clinton had won, he would have been one of the major stars in Washington, leading the Republican charge in terms of investigations against President Clinton. And when that didn't happen, and you had a Republican president and a Republican Congress, the oversight position became less visible. It was just a lesser role on Capitol Hill.
New Yorkers don't pay much attention to primaries for governor Republican primary for governor of Utah. But it sounds like it's possible that there may be a Jason Chaffetz, Mitt Romney Republican primary for governor of Utah, you think?
We'll see. I mean, Romney's been bandied about as a name for Orrin Hatch's seat. The longtime Utah senator is thinking about maybe retiring ahead of 2018.
Oh, Senate. Oh, that's what he might run for. He might run for Senate,
that's
not
right.
Governor.
That's right. I think what you're thinking about is Josh Romney, one of Romney's oldest sons. He is thinking about running for governor of Utah in 2020.
With the two of them on the ballot I guess it would be 2018. For Mitt Romney in the Senate, so you wouldn't have the two of them at the top of the ticket together for governor and U.S. senator, father and son.
One day we'll have Chelsea Clinton versus Josh Romney for president.
Donald Trump Jr. and et cetera, et cetera. So your article today, I know you got to go in a couple of minutes, but your article today about Trump's obsession with cable TV. One thing you write is that he's watching less Morning Joe since they became so critical of him from early on in the administration.
So he says.
And more Fox and Friends in the morning. Does he watch to be validated, or does he watch to learn what the buzz is on what he's doing?
Oh, I've been on the plane with him multiple times where he watches TV on a big screen, and he wants to know what the buzz is all the time, checking in to all the channels. I thought it was funny in the course of my reporting with my colleague Ashley Parker, some White House officials insisted the president never watches Morning Joe anymore, and others told us quietly, well, he actually probably does watch the 6 a.m. hour just to see what they're saying at the top of the show. So this is a president who runs on television. He thought of his public persona for so long as television-based, and it's hard for him to move away from that conception of American politics and his own popularity, away from the TV mindset. And so many lawmakers told us and diplomats that if they want to reach the president, they don't request an Oval Office meeting. They try to get on Fox News or Morning Joe.
Which brings us back to your new job hosting Washington Week. You've done so much cable TV as a guest on, I think, all three of the main cable stations. It's pretty rough and tumble in general compared to the genteel PBS NewsHour and Washington Week. So who do you see Washington Week as being for today compared to the constant drumbeat of political analysis combat shows on commercial cable.
I see Washington Week as an oasis. If you're a political junkie, or if you're someone who just reads the newspaper every day and you want to get a glass of wine at 8 o'clock on a Friday night and just sit down and know that PBS will be one place you can come once a week and have this civil conversation among just reporters. No pundits, no Republican or Democratic strategists, no commentators. Just beat reporters, strong reporters who will be civil, courteous, and I hope in-depth, and have a little fun. And it's a simple setup, no frills. I can't promise you fireworks, but I can promise you civil setting of reporters chatting. In this era of fake news, it's okay to have half an hour of some real news and real reporters. At least that's my view.
Robert Costa, still a Washington Post, White House, and congressional reporter, and NBC and MSNBC political analyst, and now the host of Washington Week, Friday nights at 8 on PBS. And I guess about 20 minutes a night, he probably even sleeps. And if you get a chance, keep coming on with us from time to time, too. Good luck with the new gig, and we'll be watching.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.